that's one of the three.
Okay. No, that's the type of something to say about like a poem. All right. Well, thanks very much for the invitation, and thanks to everybody for coming. I know that there's a lot of talks these days. And thanks also, of course, for the t-shirt, most important. So yeah, this is my title, Close-String Tachyon Dynamics. And as Freddie already pointed out, the emphasis here is really going to be on the dynamics. The tachyons serve basically as motivation in the sense that when you have a system with tachyon or with an instability, then you really can't avoid the problem of time dependence anymore. And so it focuses your mind on the problem of time dependence. But except for that, really, almost everything I say in the talk until the very end is going to be more general. It's not going to be specifically about tachyons. It's going to be attacking the problem of time dependence and string theory, so I really could have called the talk that. And then at the end, I will give applications of the equations that I'll show you to the problem of tachyons. So to get started, let me just recall some very basic facts about space-time in string theory. Of course, in GR, which is one of the antecedents to string theory, space-time is defined as a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. And in string theory, space-time can be defined as a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. In that case, we say that we have a sigma model whose target space is that manifold. But of course, in string theory, the notion of space-time is vastly generalized. We can have a general two-dimensional quantum field theory living on the string world G. It doesn't have to be a sigma model. A sigma model can be replaced with a huge family of two-dimensional quantum field theories. In the case of GR, of course, you can't have just any pseudo-Riemannian manifold. It has to obey Einstein's equations. And of course, we know from the case of the sigma model, we know in general that in string theory, you can't just have any two-dimensional quantum field theory. It has to be, for example, in the case of the Lebesgue string, a CFT with central charge 26. In the case of the superstring and superconformal field theory with central charge 15 and so on. So let me just say here that in this talk, I will be doing the bosonic string for notational simplicity, but what I say I think carries through straightforwardly to other kinds of strings. And of course, the connection between this notion and the Einstein equations in general relativity is made very concrete in the case of the sigma model, where your quantum field theory, where your target space is simply this manifold, by the fact that the Einstein equations appear as the condition for the beta functions vanishing of the beta functions for the metric in the target space. We have the usual correspondence between that what in the space-time appear to be dynamical variables on the world sheet appear to be the couplings of the theory, and what in space-time appear to be the equations of motion on the world sheet appear to be the beta functions. And that's all very well known and very well But it's particularly well studied in the case of the sigma model. But the sigma model, of course, is just one very particular kind of space-time. I'm using the word space-time here interchangeably with string background. And we want to generalize it a bit. And in particular, to generalize it, to understand more about time-dependent backgrounds in string theory. So let me just set up the problem, and then I'll write down the solution, and then we'll talk about applications. Okay. So to set it up, we start with some unitary conformal field theory. And this unitary conformal field theory is going to represent the spatial part of our string background, and or at least part of the spatial part, the part that's going to be engaged in the dynamics. And for technical reasons, just so people don't pester me later on, I'm going to require it to be compact. And if you ask me, I can say where in the equations I write down I needed that. I think that the qualitative features that I talk about will not, some of them won't change if it's a non-compact target space. And then starting with this, we just do a correspondence between basically everything can be understood either from a space-time or a world-sheet point of view. So the starting point is if the space-time is a static string background, that would correspond to the following world-sheet action. So x naught is our time direction. And sc is some of our space directions. S auxiliary is the rest of our space directions, which are not going to play any role from now on. And also the ghosts on the world sheet. So I'm just sort of, for the most part, going to forget about this part from now on. And almost all of the string backgrounds that we consider in string theory are of this form. So this background is not only static, but it's really completely decoupled between time and space, which is a stronger condition than being static. I mean, if you just consider, for example, a sigma model onto the Schwarzschild metric, that's perfectly static, but it doesn't have this decoupling because the fields of the spatial part of the target space appear in the metric. It's sitting in front of x naught. But in string theory, we're mostly restricted to actually just considering fully decoupled space and time. And the exception, really, for the most part, is the case of the sigma model, where we know that, okay, it's basically you can treat it like a space-time in general relativity, and we know the equations of motion, we're comfortable with mixing up space and time in that case. And that's really what I want to generalize here. To do that, we can talk about the excitations around this background. And those correspond on the world sheet, basically to the vertex operators in this theory. And each vertex operator will have a piece from this and a piece from this. So they're labeled basically by the operator in here. And then the operator in here is going to dress this operator to give it the correct dimensions. And so because of this correspondence, we get a picture of the configuration space as being the space of coefficients of these operators in this theory. So, okay, so we're going to expand the spatial theory in this way. And so the UAs are the couplings just of the spatial theory for the moment. Okay, so we have a configuration space for which the UAs are the coordinates, and at U equals 0, we have the theory SC, which is a conformal field theory. Now, generically, the OAs will not be marginal, and so we'll break conformal invariance by perturbing the theory by them. And of course, there may be other conformal field theories in this space. There may be some other nearby CFT. But in general, in this space, we don't have conformal field theories. Okay, so I can't just take this theory S bar, which I'll label with the point U in this space. I can't just take this S bar and tensor it with this X naught theory. Of course, I won't get a CFT.
So you could, as you said, dress those operators with some right. I K X naught. But you're not doing that.
That's what I'm about to do.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. So what we want to do precisely is to couple this theory to this one. Okay? So we're going to consider a theory which depends on a function U of X naught, which in space-time is going to represent a path or a history. Okay, so some U of X naught. Some function. And now, whereas here we didn't couple them, now we're actually going to. So, this thing, once it's taken as a function of this quantum field X naught, this becomes an operator, and now we've coupled these two theories to each other. So for any given U of X naught, we have some quantum field theory. Okay? So that's the correspondence between space-times and quantum field theories. And now, of course, the next step in the correspondence is that the equations of motion, the space-time equations of motion, are the beta functions for this function U of X naught. And that's actually a beta functional because it depends on the whole function U of X naught. And we can expand it in derivatives of U. And the equation of motion is setting that to 0. So what we did in the paper is we took this action, we took this theory. Okay, I should say one other thing, which is that I'm writing everything in terms of actions, and that's really just a notational trick. Okay, the theory SC does not have to admit a Lagrangian description. We'll just need data about it, like scaling dimensions and OPE coefficients and data functions and things. In fact, I'll be very specific about exactly what data about it we'll need. But you should just view all of this stuff about actions as being just schematic. Okay.
So Daniel, before you move to the, just to be sure, I mean, what you described here is completely standard material so far, right?
Right. Okay, but, and In the case of the sigma model, of course, you know, these beta functionals are very well known. But we want to see if we can generalize that to an arbitrary CFT, an arbitrary string background. And I'm going to see if I can make maximal use of these moving these blackboards up and down and doing that. OK, so first I'm going to start just by writing down what we got and then explaining the different pieces of it. And basically, I'm going to sort of build up these beta functions bit by bit. So this is not yet the final form they'll have. Okay, so first of all, what is this beta bar? That is the beta function for the decoupled theory S bar. So here it is. Okay, I love it. Okay, so here we have this theory, which is just a spatial theory, and it has some beta functions for the U. So the beta functions for the U define a vector field on this space of couplings, and we will take that as input data. Okay? So we'll assume that you know everything, well, that you know the beta functions for this theory. Okay? And they enter, not surprisingly, they contribute already to the U dependence of the full beta function for this theory. Okay, so just to be sure, this is the beta function for this theory, this is the beta function for this one. And this is the one that we want to set to zero, of course, at the end of the day. Okay, this term, okay, I should say that really this is there's an alpha prime in there. And I've set alpha prime to 1. This term basically comes from the k squared in the scaling dimension of e to the ik x naught. I'll go through that in a second. This is, what is this? This is the connection for a particular metric on that space, namely the Zamolodchikov metric, which is defined simply by the two-point functions at fixed separation on the world view. And again, this is in the theory S bar. Okay, so you pick a point in this space, catalytic correlator in this theory, that's your Zamolodchikov metric. Now, and then there are corrections, okay? So so what kind of corrections do we have? Well, there are two types. First of all, there are alpha prime corrections. These things are ordered alpha prime. There are higher order and alpha prime corrections, just as in the sigma model. And then there are higher order corrections in the beta bars. So this is, to some extent, this is a generalization of what we know from the sigma model in one direction, namely that we're generalizing what the spatial theory can be. But it's still in the spirit of what's done in the sigma model, which is an alpha prime expansion. Okay, so it's going to be valid for motions that are not too fast. And it's also going to be valid when the beta functions are not too large, which means that basically, once we get to talking about tachyons, it'll be accurate for light tachyons.
Okay. So, do you have some restriction on the type of operator you're turning on? Because if you turn on some wildly irrelevant operator, how are you defining this?
Right. So the last thing I just said means that the operators we turn on should be nearly marginal.
Yeah.
to put a base value. So before I wasn't specifying, but because of this, I need to have a space of nearly marginal operators that I'm turning on. Of course, there are going to be lots and lots of highly irrelevant operators and possibly highly relevant operators. And one would like to calculate, of course, one would like to know these beta functions in general, and not necessarily do it in a derivative expansion as I've done. Okay, but that's what we've done.
Can I ask, in the vein of, I think, what Gelman was asking about, I mean, this is one beta function. There's, like, if I thought of that as a space-time, this operator would also feed into the beta functions for the metric. So there's, I mean, you're not limiting yourself to being linear in U, so I would expect that introducing U is going to modify the beta functions for operators that you have there explicitly, but also operators that you set to zero. So I don't see any of those on the board.
Okay, good. So some of those operators I'm going to introduce, for example, the metric.
Okay.
The highly irrelevant operators I'm not going to bother with because it's very easy to solve their, essentially, I'm assuming that their equations motion have been solved. Okay, which is what you usually do with you know, very massive fields in string theory. It's very easy to solve the beta functions for highly irrelevant operators simply by giving them giving the couplings very small values. And then those small values for the couplings don't really affect the nearly marginal ones that you're really worried about. Okay, you're absolutely right about the metric, and I will get to that, and that's going to play a crucial role.
Okay.
Okay. Let me just go through the derivation. So in the paper, we derive this equation in two different ways. And the first way is using conformal perturbation theory. Where you are perturbing about this this CFT. And the second way is using a background field method where you do a derivative expansion you take this action and you Taylor expand U about some given value of X naught. So in the conformal perturbation theory calculation, you are not allowed to wander too far away from the starting conformal field theory. Whereas in this method, you can actually start anywhere, any value of U. Of course, subject to the caveat that the beta function shouldn't be too large at that value, then you do a Taylor expansion, and you get U dot and U double dot as couplings, and then you just do perturbation theory in those couplings. So this is basically the same thing that they do that was done by Friedan and company decades ago for the signal model. Now, let me just sketch out the conformal perturbation theory calculation. There you have the statement in any CFT that's perturbed. The beta functions can be expanded in the couplings, in a Taylor series in the couplings. The first coefficient, obviously, is the deviation from marginality. The operator here, I'm using capital letters because these couplings that we're perturbing by are for the space-time theory. So, of course, what we do, the first working first order in U is we want to, these couplings should correspond to operators with definite scaling dimension. So we take our U of X naught and we do a Fourier expansion of it. Then these operators have definite scaling dimension, which is simply given by 1/2 k² plus the scaling dimension of A. And then your beta function becomes a beta function for U tilde, and this term contributes, this term contributes the U double dot, and this term contributes the linear term in beta bar. Okay, so this part is completely standard textbook. This is basically the statement that to dress the operator, you just multiply by an appropriate e to the I k x naught, where k is on the mass shell. And the mass cell is defined by the deviation from marginality of the operator. You can go to higher order by using the standard formula from conformal perturbation theory, which tells you that the next order correction in the beta function, the quadratic correction, is given by the OPE coefficient in the CFT. And the OPE coefficient in that CFT at the top, since it's a tensor product CFT, it's just given by the product of the two OPE coefficients. And so we simply have that for this operator, for operators of this type, the OPE coefficient is given by whatever it is in the spatial theory times the OPE coefficient in the theory of the x-naughts, which is simply the momentum conserving delta function. And so here we get another term, which is just a convolution . And then, of course, if you go back to real space, what this term buys for you is the second order term in U of this. So you move that a little bit further away from the fixed point in the spatial theory. What it hasn't bought you yet is this term, which is also second order in U, so you might have expected it to show up here. And the reason it doesn't is that this formula is valid only in a coordinate system for the couplings where gamma vanishes at the fixed point. And of course, you can always choose such a coordinate system where gamma vanishes at a given point. Therefore, in that coordinate system, this gamma is absent. And then if you, because the whole equation is covariant, if you go to a generic coordinate system, you'll pick up this term.
So if you're using this method, you're very, very close to U equals zero, right?
Right.
So here you don't have to assume that the dimension is very close to two.
Okay, this formula, as it's written, is also only true for a small scale. Now, actually, the exact formula is known. For this quadratic coefficient as a function of the scaling dimensions, and it's, you know, it involves some gamma functions, it's moderately complicated. So in principle, I could have...
What I meant is that you want the beta functions to be small as well, so that correction will not, the beta squared correction will not affect, you can neglect it.
Right.
So here, if you're very close to U equals zero.
But I don't necessarily want to be so close. For example, you know, I mean, it's well known that there are fixed points in some CFTs that are so close to each other that each one is accessible to the other in conformal perturbation theory. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the kind of situation where you'll have sort of a light tachyon, and then you can consider condensing that attack line to get to the other one. But you really, for that to work, you need this to be small and this to be sort of not too small. Okay. So I really do need, you know, I could have generalized, because I do know the exact quadratic coefficient, I could have generalized this calculation to the case where this is not small, but it wouldn't actually have bought me very much. Because in that case, as soon as you move away, you really need to take into account all of the terms, and I don't know all of the higher order terms. Okay, so that's, you know, basically derivation number one of this formula, and the, you know, the only thing that's sort of, the only thing that's new in it is the quadratic term in U. This method, I think, is somewhat more general in the sense that you don't have to be near a fixed point, but you know, it gives the same result. Okay, now let's get back to Rob's question, which is that I've missed some beta functions. I've actually, there are several things that I've totally dropped so far. One thing I've dropped is the beta function for this metric coefficient, which I haven't even written because I've gone to a gauge where it's equal to minus one, which certainly I can do without levels of generality. But as Rob points out, just because I've chosen to go to a gauge doesn't mean that I can forget about its beta functions, just as in GR, although I've fixed the gauge, doesn't mean I can throw out the equation of motion for the metric components that I fixed. They turn into constraints. So this is going, and this one in particular corresponds to the Hamiltonian constraint. And so we need to calculate that. Another thing that I've left out, just because I feel like somebody's probably about to jump on me for it, is that I have not mentioned at all, you know, it's not sufficient to have, it's necessary but not sufficient to have a conformal field theory to have the energy beta functions. One also needs to have a conformal field theory with the correct central charge. And I will get to that.
Another thing that, I mean, not only you, but most people neglect check for maybe non-critical strings is that you could also have other operators in which the ghost and the matter do not be coupled.
Yeah.
And those have learned non-critical strings, they play an important role. So there is something that not only you, everyone in the
world. Yeah.
Do you have something to say about those in this context?
I mean, not really. I think that that's an interesting issue. My understanding is that those correspond to non-trivial dilaton couplings, that it's, that if you have, basically because after you've done your gauge fixing on the world sheet, the dilaton vertex operator involves the ghosts. And so those kind of couplings that you're talking about basically have to do with having non-trivial dilaton profiles in the space-time. It's not a completely new set of degrees of freedom that we never heard of before, these couplings to the ghosts. It's a rearrangement of couplings to of basically the dilaton coupling.
I think that's true in the more standard sort of flat space CFT, but non-critical strings are definitely new states that live in the realistic homology of the string, and you said something with those. The problem that I think in flat space is that they don't really play a role except in this minimal way via the dilaton coupling. But in general, if you're doing a very general setup of a CFT,
right,
you could have to.
I see.
You would have
okay.
To
okay.
But are they really? I mean, they're also, you know, all of these whatever high. I mean, these stringy states, which I can imagine in an appropriate gauge. It's not just the dilaton, but other modes of the string. Their vertex operators could pick up ghosty parts.
I think
the. No, I think you're saying it's distinct
yeah,
from that.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask that, just since we derailed you, I mean, there's also other, like, I mean, I don't know how to say it here, but if, again, if it was a metric, there'd be a G0i and a B0i.
Good.
You implicitly set the zero again, and those also become constraints.
Right. So first of all, I mean, I can set those to zero. There, that is a gauge choice.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
But okay, yeah, but then they show up. Let's see, those constraints, right, so those correspond to operators, I mean, that look like, basically, I'm going to dodge this question. I mean, they correspond to, if you have some operator in SC which has dimension 0, 1,
yeah,
then you can write dx naught, so let's say O, dx naught O, and then you have a nice 1, right, 1 operator. Those are the ones you're talking,
yeah,
about. And basically, the assumption I'm going to make is that you can that those, I mean, those will give additional constraints, and I'm going to assume that those constraints can be solved. I mean, if you have a generically, if you have a compact CFT, you're not going to have primary operators of this form. It, just like generically, if you have a compact CFT, you're not going to have nearly marginal operators. Okay, nearly marginal primary operators. And so for the special CFTs that do, it would be even more special if they also had primary operators like this. And so, but if they do, then I mean, basically, I think it's an interesting question, and we haven't done all the calculations for it, but I think you can probably deal with it. My feeling is that it doesn't give qualitatively new, but I mean, that could be wrong, so why don't I just not say anything more before I say something wrong?
It's recorded, so
yeah. Okay. This one we did calculate. This one is always there. This is what we got, and it's at this point, it looks like a pretty big problem. Why? Because this is a unitary theory, SC. The spatial theory is unitary. Therefore, the homological metric is positive definite. Therefore, the only way you can set this guy to zero is by having the u dot zero. If the u dots are zero, then you better have beta bar zero. And then you're back in the situation you started with. I mean, you might be at a different CFT, but it's just as boring as the one that you started with. And so if this were really the end of the story, then, you know, certainly we wouldn't have any, the statement would be that there are no time-dependent backgrounds in string theory, which is certainly hogwash. Okay, so, what have I left out? What I've left out is this business of the central charge, and the thing that enforces the central charge in string theory is the beta function for the dilaton. And the dilaton is a massless field in space-time, and you can't just forget about it. And in fact, what I've basically proven to you is that if you do forget about it, then you'll have nothing but static solutions. In other words, the dilaton will necessarily get excited in this class of time-dependent solutions. So we need to add the dilaton, and that we did, and it's not hard to calculate its effect on the beta functions or its own beta function. You can use standard methods. Basically, it's an improvement term in the world sheet stress tensor. Therefore, it changes the trace of the stress tensor and the beta functions of the coefficients of the different operators in the trace of the stress tensor. So it's a very easy procedure to get out the dilaton's contribution. So I could now be adding dilatons to those actions, but you all know what they look like. And here we get, and the answers are this is basically just as in the sigma model, the dmu dnu term in the beta function for the metric component, and then for this, we have the, I'm just trying to get the signs right here. Okay, this term is the box phi term in the Dilaton beta function. This term is the dmu phi squared term. Now, what is this? Well, this is just like we have a beta bar u here, a beta bar a here. Once I add a Dilaton coupling to this theory, and I won't resist the temptation to raise and lower these blackboards another time. So I've added this. And now I'm equally well adding it here. Okay, and so this theory, of course, there's a new coupling. That coupling has a beta function, and that's what I'm calling beta bar phi. And it's a scalar field on this space. So now we have the beta bar A, which is a vector field, we have a metric, and we also have a scalar field. So there's a lot of data about that space of theories that we're going to need. And now one thing we do know about it is that on a CFT, so at one of the fixed points, of course, it's equal to 1/6 of the central charge at that fixed point. And this is for the central charge of the auxiliary directions, and this is for the time direction. And
do you need a contribution from the Lewis?
It's in here. This includes the minus 26 for the Lewis. Okay, so these equations are the basic result of the paper. These are the main result of the paper. And yeah.
Am I not still stuck with more equations than I have?
Perfect. We are still stuck with more equations than variables, but it's okay because one combination is a constraint. And it's not quite just this, because now we have this phi double dot. So what it is this. Okay, where I just subtract a quarter of this guy to get rid of this phi double dot, and then we get something that only has first derivatives. Okay. And so in fact, the Hamiltonian constraint is not quite this, but it's this. And it does look quite a bit like the Hamiltonian, where this, which doesn't have any u dots in it, is playing the role of the potential energy, and this is playing the role of the kinetic energy, and the Dilaton contributes negatively to the kinetic energy. Okay, that's just a simple operation that this is a linear combination of equations of motion that doesn't contain the second derivatives. But if you have a constraint, then for consistency, and this is really the content of Rob's question, it's not enough just to say, well, one of the linear combinations doesn't have a second derivative. For consistency, you need that to be a conserved quantity. Otherwise, you indeed have more equations than unknowns. And so what we need is for h dot to be a conserved quantity. And let me make that more precise. In the following way, more rigorous, let's say we have a background in which these two beta functions vanish, but I haven't said that beta phi vanishes. Then we have a CFT. We don't know what the central charge is, but we have a CFT. If we have a CFT, then beta phi, then it's a theorem, which you derive from the Wessimino consistency condition for the Weyl anomaly, it's a theorem that beta phi has to be a C number. Okay. In other words, it's not an operator. It can't depend on x naught. Okay. So this implies, this must imply, that beta phi is conserved. Okay. And I'm going to prefer to write it in this way, which is basically the statement I just made, that we need h to be a conserved quantity. And that's a theorem about quantum field theory in two dimensions. Okay. You can't get around it. Now, so we need this to be a fact about these equations of motion. But h involves beta phi bar, whereas these equations, which we are supposed to, upon which the statement depends, involve beta a bar. And so we need some relation between them. And of course, the relation is basically this really does have to be a potential in the sense that beta a bar really does have to be the gradient of beta phi bar. So this implies the following equation, which relates these different quantities. And I think in the conventions I've been using, there's a 2 there. This relation is a statement about the theory S bar. Okay? It's a statement about the one that's fitting. It's a statement about the quantities on this space. I've derived it by adding this auxiliary x naught and then going through some gymnastics, but it's a statement that needs to be true just about the S bar theory by itself. Okay? And I think it's quite an interesting statement. Now,
in particular, it applies to all of those theories, not just conformal.
Right, it's a statement about the space of theories.
Okay.
Okay? Which include, right, I mean, the conformal ones are important. Now, of course, my derivation of it, although this last step was rigorous, the equations, of course, have all kinds of corrections, and so we would only, certainly the derivation is only valid for a small beta bar. Okay? But nonetheless, I think it's very interesting and suggestive. And it's telling us that this guy is some kind of a potential or maybe a C function on the space of couplings. I don't think that as it's written with this equal to the Zamolodchikov metric, this is going to be generally true. In fact, I can prove that it's not. Okay, that this is not quite the correct thing with this being the Zamolodchikov metric. Basically by using formulas that Zamolodchikov wrote down in his paper, where, as I said, he computed beta bar, the quadratic term in the expansion of beta bar exactly in a coordinate system in which GAB is fixed to be to have vanishing gamma. And you can show using those formulas that if beta bar is not small, then this left-hand side is not a closed one form on the space of couplings. So there's no chance of it being the gradient of something. So I think that this is true. I mean, I've shown that it's true for small beta bar. It's false when beta bar is not true. But hopefully something like it would be true where you correct this Zamolodchikov metric to be some smarter kind of metric. Okay. But I think this is quite interesting. Okay, I'm almost done, but I can't be completely done because I haven't talked about closed string tachyons yet. But now all I'm going to do is just take what I've learned and see what it tells us generally about closed string tachyons, about their dynamics. So, because Freddie mentioned cosmology, I have to use the word landscape. So I'm going to plot this potential landscape. So let's, you know, it's something. There are several kinds of features I want. Actually, is this going to? okay, so let's say that this potential function is some crazy function of the coupling. I'm just doing one coupling for now for simplicity. And as we learned, the beta functions for the coupling itself are simply the gradient. And the CFTs are the extrema. If this function is positive at an extremum, then we have a supercritical theory, meaning we can make a string background by tensoring it with a time-like linear dilaton theory. If you have an extremum where it's zero, then you have just a standard critical theory, and if it's less than zero, then you can't tensor it with anything to get a string background. There are no static solutions to those equations at an extremum where this function is negative. Okay, so here we need phi dot not zero. Now,
If I were to tensor that with a space-like linear dilaton, I would have thought I could raise it up, but you're not letting me do that for.
Well, then that's just changing C auxiliary, right? I mean, you're saying,
okay,
you know, make S auxiliary a space-like linear dilaton, and then that's the filter just change.
Okay.
So yeah, you can freely move it up and down by adding a space-like linear dilaton. Absolutely. Or I guess you can freely move it up by adding a space-like linear dilaton. Wow, I managed to draw a very complicated potential that nonetheless misses one of the features I wanted to point out. So I'm going to make it even more complicated. Sorry. Okay, this is more like what I wanted. Okay, so the question is, what happens if you start at one of these? I mean, if it's a maximum, then there's a tachyon. If it's a minimum, it's stable. What happens if you start at one of the ones with the tachyon? And in particular, one of the questions that we wanted to address in this project was, how does the behavior as a function of time relate to the renormalization group flow just of the spatial theory that is seeded by the vertex operator, the undressed vertex operator for the tachyon? Okay, so the undressed meaning not dressed with an e to the ikx naught, which puts it on shell, that tachyon vertex operator, which is going to be one of the OAs, is going to be a relevant operator, and it's become a more or less standard in the post-string tachyon literature because it's so hard to deal with the dynamics per se to study the RG flow of the spatial theory. Okay, so to just boldly and bravely go off shell and move through the space of non-conformal field theories, eventually you'll hit some IR fixed point, and you declare that to be the endpoint of closed-string tachyon condensation, right, in that system. And with these equations, we can make some observations about that, about the relation between the actual motion in time and the RG flow. And it's very simple and actually relates to a very old observation. Basically, phi dot will contribute either friction or anti-friction depending on its sign. So again, assuming we're starting a supercritical theory, if phi dot is positive, then we have anti-friction or anti-damp motion. And because of this second equation, you see that phi double dot is a positive definite quantity. And so phi dot is always increasing in time. So if initially phi dot is positive, it will always be positive from then on. And so the motion will always be anti-damped. And it's very hard for anti-damped motion to settle at any kind of a fixed point. Generically, what it'll do is it'll basically run off to infinity in finite time. Certainly, it can never, if you're running down the hill, stop at a fixed point with a lower value of the potential. But it can, if find dot is negative, and then it becomes a quantitative question of whether it does or not. It depends on the strength of phi dot, which in turn depends on how high up the potential you are. You will roll down a hill, and if it's overdamped, you'll just come to a stop. If it's underdamped, you'll oscillate back and forth. And if it's really too weak, then you may end up in a different fixed point altogether. And if you ever go below zero, then you can never stop because of what I said before at such a fixed point. Okay? So basically the lesson is, for the trajectories that do end because of, the lesson is that if you have phi dot sufficiently negative, then it can happen that the time evolution ends at the same place as the RG flow. Of course, quantitatively, the path will be different because that's a second order equation, whereas the RG flow is a first order equation, but qualitatively, it'll be very similar. And this is basically, there's a limit of this. So this I derived, you know, sort of assuming that you have weak beta functions. But I think that the statement is qualitatively much more general than that. And in particular, it relates to a very old observation, which, to my knowledge, was first made by Cooper, Susskind, and Thorlacius, that if you have a supercritical theory with a very, very large central charge, then the time dynamics will indeed mimic the RG flow of the spatial theory. And that argument goes via, basically, you just start with the spatial theory on the world sheet, and then you couple it to quantum gravity, and so you grow a time direction in that way. The bottom node of the metric, of the world sheet metric, becomes the time direction. And if the original world sheet theory has a very large central charge, then that quantum gravity theory will be can be treated semi-classically, and you can show very easily that if that original theory was not a conformal field theory, but actually had running couplings, then you'll basically get a time dependence which follows the same, which follows the RG flow.
I'm sorry, I'm confused.
Yeah.
Isn't it generally true that beta function equations are equivalent to equations of motion for the coupling?
So normally, so the full beta function, so the RG flow that I'm talking about is the RG flow generated by the beta bars. The betas of the full space-time theory, of course, have to be zero.
Yeah.
Okay? But as you move around in the space of couplings, you're not always going to get places where beta bar is true. Okay, so the RG flows that I'm talking about are in just the spatial theory, and they can go from fixed point to fixed point. Those are the RG flows that I'm talking about. Okay, and the question is whether the actual time dependence. This RG flow is a function of world sheet scale, some renormalization scale on the world sheet, right? Whereas the time dependence I've been talking about so far, everything is a function of x0. Okay, and the question is whether the equations of motion reduce in some limit to the renormalization group equations, in the sense that the x0 dependence will be the same, or maybe after some rescaling will be the same as the dependence on the renormalization scale. Okay. And it was already known that in the limit of a supercritical theory with a very large central charge, in other words, and a negative slope, that indeed the beta functions for the full theory would reduce to simply saying that the time dependence should mimic the renormalization group flow. In other words, what's happening is that the equations become first order. If phi dot is extremely large, then these terms become negligible, and you're simply left with the equation that u dot equals beta bar a rescaled by some factor.
So what is the meaning of this RG scale? What is the meaning of this RG scale?
So far in what I've been saying, in our calculation, it doesn't refer to anything. You just use these data of the beta bars, okay? And the actual renormalization group flow of this theory, of this S bar theory, doesn't play any direct role. It's just that the beta bars show up in the equation. But in the argument of Cooper, Susskind, and Thorlacius, what happens is that as you usually do in a non-critical string theory, you start out with a world sheet theory which is non-critical, that won't be a gravitational theory. You couple it to gravity. Now you have a new degree of freedom which doesn't decouple because your original theory was not critical. Okay? That the bottom mode of the quantum gravity on the world sheet will be the x naught. Okay, so it'll give you a time direction in space-time. And because it was the bottom mode of the metric, it corresponds to the scale factor on the world sheet. And so there's a correspondence between the value of x naught and the scale at which you're probing the spatial part of the theory. And so there's a correspondence between x naught and the renormalization scale for this theory. This being the theory that you couple to world sheet gravity. I'm not sure I've explained that very clearly. But suffice it to say that it was known previously that when phi dot was large, that these equations had the property that they reduced to first order equations, and that those first order equations were simply the renormalization group equations of this part of the theory. So that feature was already known. And that feature is much more generally true than the derivation of these equations that I've presented. Okay, so the point is, I mean, for anybody in the audience who, you know, it's funny, the last time I came to Perimeter, I gave a talk on the relation between closed string tachyon dynamics and world sheet RG flow. So obviously I haven't moved very far since then. And that talk was presenting an argument that that if you have a non-compact space-time, then under world sheet RG flow, the space-time energy did decrease, and so it was sort of an argument in support of this correspondence. And again, this is another argument in support of the correspondence, but it's more precise. It tells you when you can expect it to be true and when you shouldn't expect it to be true. And I think that's where I'll leave it. Thanks very much.
Any more questions for Matt?
So when you're, I guess I'm not sure what the, or how strong the quantum statement is. I mean, if you start, you have this constraint, but the sign of phi dot in the constraint is arbitrary. So can I say that if I want the solution to look like the RG flow, I just, that says that I have to choose?
Right, exactly.
So it's not that, so in some sense, I can expect that there is a solution out there that looks like RGFlow, but you're sort of saying I have to be careful about sort of the data or whatever that I...
Yeah, initial conditions. There. I mean, it depends how much, you know, I mean, the issue is, if you come to me with some system with, that has a closed string tag now and ask, you know, what's going to happen to it, if you've really told me all of the initial conditions, including phi dot, then that phi dot had better have the right sign. And also, the theory had better be supercritical. If you start out with something that looks like this, critical theory with a tachyon, you can forget it. It's never going to stop at an infrared fixed point. I mean, of course, if, you know, it's clear, you know, our RGFlow is just a simpler process, a first order process. You have half as many initial conditions. So it's, and plus, you don't have a dilaton in the RGFlow. It's just a statement about what's happening to the spatial theory all by itself. Okay? Unless it has some dilaton, you know, as a function of the spatial coordinates, but you don't have this extra degree of freedom of the zero mode in space of the dilaton. Okay, so it's just a much simpler process. For the time evolution, there's all this extra data. So of course it's not surprising that, you know, whether or not the time evolution mimics the RGFlow depends on certain choices that are made for the extra data. Mm-hmm. So that's all, and we're just making that more precise and telling you exactly what choice you gotta make if you do want it to mimic. Okay. I should also say that this phenomenon has been seen in this supercritical heterotic example studied by Kellerman and Liu, where they studied these supercritical heterotic theories that had tachyons, and what happened was that they started, when the tachyons condensed, if you had, and in their analysis it's quite clear, that they had a negative slope timeline linear dilaton, that you would lose dimensions and eventually drop back down to the critical heterotic theory, which of course is where they were dealing with the supersymmetric one, so it had no tachyons. And also the example of the minimal models where you have this this structure with CFTs that are very close to each other, and light tachyons, the time-dependent solutions that take you from one to the next were studied by Sen in string field theory, and again, he needed this negative slope linear dilaton.
Can you see from those examples, or can you make any statements about what happens when the sign is wrong? Or, I mean, what does it go somewhere interesting, or it just...
Well, generically what happens is that when you have, let's imagine, for example, that you had a modulus, okay, some flat direction, a whole family of CFTs with, of course, the same central charge, and you chose the wrong sign. And then you kick it a little bit. What'll happen is it'll go to infinity in finite time. And it's easy to write down the exact solution for that motion. And it is possible for that, I think that's the generic behavior, it is possible for that not to happen if you have a potential whose slope is steep enough, then the beta bar can actually fight the anti-damping and bring the thing to a halt. So, right, because the point is that this thing contributes negatively to the energy.
Right.
So there's no end of energy that you can add to the rest of the system simply by increasing phi dot. Right. So, and that's what happens in the anti-damping, is that phi dot is by dot squared is increasing. And so there's just more and more energy being pumped into the system. Whereas in the opposite case, when phi dot is negative, phi dot is still increasing, but phi dot squared is decreasing. And so it's sucking energy out of the system. Is that the kind of...
Well, those are, yeah, maybe we can talk about them more later. I mean, the last statement, though, or the one you made about a critical string theory, is that saying then that these ideas that the bosonic string will decay into something, that's all just a fantasy?
Yeah, if you start in the critical 26-dimensional bosonic string theory, I mean, unless this stuff is qualitatively wrong, which I doubt. Okay, because our analysis is not applied to that. Okay.
Of course.
There is no way that it can, you know, stop at some lower dimension. Like, you know, one common fantasy is that it'll stop at the t equals one string. Okay. Forget it. It's not going to happen.
Could it be, though, that alpha prime corrections are going to qualitatively change the equations? Like, I mean, I expect that sort of, I don't know, it could be phi dot to the fourth or other terms in your H equation.
You'll certainly have higher derivatives of U. I mean, I'm not sure, but the reason that I trust the qualitative conclusion is that we have this other data point, which is that as an exact statement, at large phi dot, the equations reduce to beta bar minus phi dot u dot.
Okay.
So in the limit, phi dot goes to minus infinity, beta a goes to beta bar a minus phi dot u dot.
Can you have higher derivatives of phi dot?
In this? No, I'm saying this I know is an exact statement. I'm not deriving this from that. I know this independently. This is the Cooper-Susskind correlations argument. Okay, so since I flubbed the earlier explanation of that argument, let me try once again. Okay, the framework is completely different. Okay, but the endpoint is the same. The framework is you start with a non-gravitational theory on the world shape, specifically this one. Okay? Forget the dilaton. Okay, some non-gravitational theory on the world shape.
What do you mean by non-gravitational theory on the world shape? I mean, it always has to cover the matter.
And then you couple it to world shape gravity, as you have to.
Oh, you mean you write it as eta mu nu plus h mu nu? Is that what you mean? No. I don't quite understand. I mean,
well, just imagine you have a two-dimensional field theory. It's not a conformal field theory. It's just a two-dimensional field theory.
Oh.
And then we covariant.
You don't start with a string.
Right, we're going to get a string background. The string background is world-shaped gravity. You start with some 2D field theory, couple it to world-shaped gravity, quantize, okay? Then, I mean, this is the usual thing you do. For example, if the theory you start with is a single time-like boson, then after you do this, you get the usual C equals one string background, right? Where the spatial linear dilaton in that case came from the Weyl mode of the world sheet gravity, the world sheet metric. And it because the original theory is non-critical, if c equals 1, that thing has a linear deliton. Now do it again, but start with the theory that has c greater than 25. Well, if you do a c equals to 25, then you get precisely the c equals 26 critical string theory, okay, flat state. If you do it with c greater than 25, then you get a time-like linear deliton. Okay, if you do it with c much greater than 25, then the gravity on the world sheet becomes classical. Okay, it becomes weakly coupled. And then, when you want to set the beta functions for the whole thing, you have this whole quantum gravity plus matter system on the world sheet. You need its beta functions to vanish. Okay. But if the gravity part is weakly coupled, then it doesn't change the beta functions for the what I'm calling the spatial theory, which is this original non-gravitational theory you started with, which is this S bar. Okay. So what's going to happen is that because you now have a dynamical metric, and so how should I say this? If you so x naught now is representing the Weyl mode of the metric. If you probe this theory with some coordinate momentum k, then that gets translated by this Weyl mode of the metric into a proper momentum e to the x naught times k. And so you're probing the non-gravitational part of the theory at a momentum which depends on x naught. And so you end up with the renormalization group flow generated by the beta bar fibered over the x naught direction. That's the space-time picture of this coupling to gravity and so on. Okay, the space-time picture is that you have whatever renormalization group flow the non-gravitational theory had before it was coupled to gravity, fibered over the x naught direction. Okay? And that is the statement that beta bar, that the full beta function is whatever the beta bar was, and now take phi dot to be constant. Okay? And therefore it tells you that the u of x naught is the same as u along the RG flow. The path in the space of u's that's followed is simply generated by the beta bar function. So for example, if you have some uv fixed point and an ir fixed point, then it's going to do this motion in real time. Okay. So that is an argument from a completely different direction. It's totally general. And it tells me that I know what the full beta functions are in this limit. And that suggests to me that there aren't going to be higher order in phi dot corrections.
But what Jem is saying, I mean, what you've argued is exactly that, that there aren't higher order in phi dot, but on the other hand, you could have higher order, you could have phi double dot, phi triple dot, phi, you know. And so I might, instead of having that kinetic term, you could imagine having phi double dot squared with some appropriate sign. And so that might change the motion or the qualitative behavior when phi is running away or trying to. Mm-hmm.
The design you use doesn't say anything that stops at one day to be phi, or is there some argument that there are no higher order derivatives?
No, I don't. I mean, this argument basically you have a linear deliton, like linear deliton. So I don't think it tells you anything about phi double dots and phi double dots. I mean, I'd have to think about it, but.
But in fact, you know, from the, you know, the string equations of motion, that there are higher order terms in phi. I mean, in the same way that you get like r to the fourth terms,
yeah,
those are addressed by all sorts of dilaton terms.
Yeah, I'm not saying that those terms don't exist. It's the question is whether they qualitatively change.
Yeah. No, but that's it. Then there's a question one has to ask.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a possibility, a strong possibility.
Hence my caveat.
Yeah. Okay.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank Matt again.